Number 10, be prepared. Millions will flee cities. A common theme in my fictional post-apocalyptic series, a series titled The Civil Strife Series, is that amid a widespread societal and economic collapse, millions will flee from the large cities. Bugging out will not be an idea or action unique to preppers. Preppers may be the first to bug out, but those that live in suburban and rural areas should be prepared for a massive influx of outsiders, outsiders that predominantly will be traveling from urban areas. This will present many challenges. It'll put a strain on resources for the same reason that the high population density of a city puts a strain on resources. It'll contribute to some of the same problems created by a lack of emergency and essential services, such as an increase in garbage, human waste, and crime. In fact, I would expect crime to be far more common in many medium and small towns than some would expect, and I believe much of that will be as a result of this mass migration out of cities. A sizable portion, I believe, will revolve around individuals fleeing from cities in search of food and other necessities for themselves and their family. Some of the crimes will likely be related to those that had no regard for the law before any collapse. Gang and cartel members, criminals, etc., will carry that attitude with them should they leave city limits. Imagine, for example, the crime and violence characteristic of a city like Chicago. Such crime will inevitably bleed into surrounding suburbs and the countryside should such individuals decide to leave the city. Of course, the vast majority of those leaving these large cities will not set out with intent of taking advantage of any lawlessness. Unfortunately, many in suburban and rural areas will be unable to or refuse to make that distinction. Another segment of the increase in crime will occur because of a clash of ideas and identities. Regardless of either party's intent, assumptions will be made of all individuals fleeing cities, and those fleeing are also likely to make similarly negative assumptions about those living in suburban and rural areas. This will inevitably lead to conflict, crime, and violence. I think it's important to understand that what I'm describing here is not my own xenophobic or anti-city dweller bias. That's simply not the case. We should remember that some problems, such as crime, will also be quite common in rural areas, as many locals will, in the absence of law enforcement and a criminal justice system, become a threat to their fellow neighbors. However, even if I don't necessarily hold such a bias towards either party, it doesn't mean that a vast majority of Americans will. This bias may not necessarily even be an anti-urbanite bias, nor racism or prejudice towards certain ethnicities. Much of this conflict that I believe will occur between rural, suburban, and urban individuals will be from a position of fear. Those fleeing cities will be fearful for their lives, and such fear will be amplified in unfamiliar territory and among unfamiliar people. Those that are local to suburban and rural areas will feel that their backyard, in essence, has been invaded by outsiders. It's an understandable response, and it puts both parties in a situation with no easy answers. Both parties want to survive, provide for their family, and likely will enter into such scenarios without a desire to infringe upon their fellow human beings to achieve those means, with some exceptions. However, when food supplies run low and other necessities are scarce, I believe many have the potential to turn to theft, violence, discrimination, and similar acts to keep themselves and their family alive. Once again, I'm not advocating for such crime or violence, nor am I advocating for any animosity between either party. I'm simply describing the circumstances and how I believe they will play out. So, where does this leave you? You, the prepper that was supposed to be prepared for any number of adverse scenarios, suddenly find yourself amid conflict between two or more groups of people. If you live in a non-urban area and your first instinct will be to side with the locals. Your friends, family members, and other residents of your town or surrounding small communities will be the ones that you will be the most inclined to support. Their arguments will sound the most compelling, and it's likely many local leaders will become figureheads for this animosity. However, Deciding to take one side or the other has some serious ramifications and will take wisdom and discernment. The last thing that you want is for your decision to increase or feed into any animosity between your local community and those fleeing large cities. It's difficult for me to say this with any certainty that I would stand up for those that are without shelter, without food, and at a very real risk of death. The truth of the matter is that you, your family, and your loved ones will be at a similar, albeit smaller, risk of an adverse outcome. However, it is my personal belief that each prepper has some amount of responsibility to stand up for those with less, for those that have been displaced, and for those in need. Many will object to this based on such individuals being deserving of such a fate because of their lack of foresight. I spent years preparing and thousands of dollars of real money to make sure that myself and my family would make it through to the other end. They didn't prepare at all. Some of them laughed and mocked people like me. Why do they deserve any mercy? Why do they deserve any share of what us preppers have stored for ourselves? Why do they deserve the benefits of the water, land, and other natural resources that are plentiful in my local area? Look, they're all valid questions and once again demonstrate that there are no easy answers to these questions. At the end of the day, it sometimes can appear to be a zero-sum game. Either they survive or else myself and my loved ones survive. However, I'd caution you against such thinking. There certainly will be scenarios in which that's the case. With that being said, such a mindset, when adopted by the vast majority of those living in non-urban areas, will lead to both a large amount of animosity and conflict, as well as a higher number of deaths, especially among those fleeing the city. It's easy to say that you don't care about those individuals, but those men and women and children that will be dying are as much human as you and I. Charity, generosity, and even integration of those fleeing their urban conditions into your community can be valuable and rewarding in practical terms. For example, we previously discussed the huge food needs for even a moderate-sized family. Those caloric needs will translate to massive amounts of land that will need to be worked, often with limited or no assistance from modern-day machinery and farming equipment due to the lack of such equipment being present and a scarcity of fuel. Those fleeing from cities can certainly help in that regard. I'm not proposing some sort of modern-day slavery. I'm talking about those that are put in a precarious position using their labor to ensure that they and their family survive until some sort of normality returns. Farming is one example, but countless other duties and tasks can be delegated to those that will be working for their food and position in the community. On the topic of charity and integration, remember that your voice is important. As I said before, you'll likely be met with a chorus of skepticism and animosity towards those fleeing the large cities. It's easy to go along with that popular opinion, and it will be difficult to dissent. However, if you can form a coalition large enough, assisting to meet the needs of such individuals becomes far easier when it no longer is your pantry alone that's supplying their meals, but also the pantries and fields of many other community members. In summary, many of the benefits of living in a rural or suburban area will be diminished as large groups of people fleeing urban areas seek refuge in less crowded locales. Such migration is likely to lead to animosity and conflict, and those leaving urban areas will be in an extremely vulnerable position. It's important that you stand up for such individuals, that you advocate for them, and if you feel led to do so, that you communicate with others in your community and devise a plan to help meet their needs. Tip number 11, bug in, not out. For those fortunate enough to live in rural and suburban areas, it is my opinion that bugging out is unnecessary except in very specific circumstances. Before I explain why I feel this way, let's first cover those specific circumstances. Natural disasters are an obvious reason to bug out. Wildfires, hurricanes, earthquakes, and similar disasters can make bugging out necessary and prudent. Less likely, but still possible scenarios, such as finding yourself downwind from a nuclear blast or nuclear disaster and its associated fallout, is another potential reason to bug out from your rural or suburban location. Certain conflicts for certain people may also justify bugging out. For example, hypothetically, if Canada were to invade the United States, it might make sense for those living near the border to move south. It's an absurd scenario, but far more likely for other individuals in different geographical locations that may be at a greater risk for a military conflict in their area. And, of course, this military conflict may not be a result of a foreign government, but could also be due to a domestic unrest or civil war. Martial law in your area may also prompt you to bug out. None of those circumstances will, in all cases, warrant bugging out, but doing so increases the odds of such an action being prudent. With those exceptions out of the way, let's discuss some of the benefits of bugging in. First, there is familiarity. You are familiar with your house, your property, and your neighborhood. Any navigation or defense of the surrounding area will be easier because of that familiarity. Positive relationships with those in your neighborhood and community will also allow you to engage in community-based approaches to survival. As countless others in the prepping community have advised, a community-based approach to prepping and survival is far more likely to allow you to both survive and thrive when compared to a lone wolf approach. Generally, for those that live in suburban or rural areas, any bug out plans involve relocating to a very rural site. Living in a very rural area near other locals that you may not know will have the effect of making fewer contacts with other humans. In some scenarios, this can decrease the risk of conflict. However, such positioning, especially if a few locals in the area are strangers to you and your family, will leave you less able to draw on the benefits of a community when it comes to resource sharing, large community projects, and defense. Another obvious benefit of remaining in your current residence is space. Bugging out generally involves the use of a vehicle to transport yourself and your family from point A to point B. Of course, bugging out on foot can be necessary in some scenarios, such as those discussed in a previous tip. Unless you're planning on multiple trips, you're quite limited in space when it comes to transporting your physical preps, such as food, water, guns, and ammo, and many of the other necessities for survival. Depending on the size of your family, even more space will be taken up by their bodies and by even the most basic necessities, such as several sets of clothing. Of course, multiple trips are possible in some circumstances, and storing some of your preps in your bug-out location, assuming it's a cabin, a second house, or some other type of residence that is in your possession, is a possible solution. But it requires you to store such preps off-site, where they're prone to theft. Cameras, alarms, and fences around a house or property can help deter such theft, but are hardly foolproof. Having predetermined that bugging out is the best option from your non-urban residence also raises the question of what should happen if you're unable to reach your bug-out location. If it's 50 miles away from your house and roads are impassable or your vehicle doesn't work, how should you prepare for such a scenario? Should you have a large number of preps in your main residence? You're then forced to prepare for both contingencies and space out your preps between two separate locations. No prepper has unlimited amounts of money, meaning that the preps in any given location will be less than optimal given your limited financial resources. Such problems can complicate things in a time in which simplification is oftentimes preferable. As previously stated, there are situations in which bugging out is warranted. For some, such as those in urban areas, it may be the most ideal decision for most collapse and disaster scenarios. However, for those that are on the more rural or somewhat suburban side of the spectrum, it becomes much easier to plan for a wide variety of adverse scenarios if your base case is bugging in, not out, and bugging out is simply a contingency you have in place for very specific disasters or scenarios. The benefits of familiarity, a community in which you know your neighbors and they know you, and the space of your current residence relative to a single or multiple bug-out vehicles makes bugging in the most realistic and ideal decision for a large number of preppers. Tip number 12, don't count out communication networks in the internet. The ability to communicate across large distances instantaneously is a benefit of modern-day communication networks and the internet. Many preppers, and rightfully so, prepare for such networks and the internet itself to be non-functional in a variety of adverse scenarios. And indeed, preparing for such scenarios is wise. Radios, including ham radios, handheld radios, CB radios, and even radios that allow you to only listen to broadcasts, such as those relating to weather or disaster information, are a wise investment for preppers. However, as is the case with many aspects of prepping, we must prepare for the worst case scenario while also understanding that disasters and prepping scenarios can stretch across a wide spectrum of severity. Many preppers seem to assume that modern day communication networks and the internet will be non-functional in most widespread collapses. Grid down scenarios, major societal and economic collapses, and even and events of similar severity are often assumed to leave the vast majority of the population devoid of the ability to communicate through using communication networks and unable to access the internet. I believe that access to modern communication networks, such as cellular networks or satellite-based communication networks, would be a valuable asset in the worst-case scenarios that are often dreamt up should they remain functional. The internet and communication networks could offer the average prepper a valuable outside source of information. I think it's naive of us to assume that such means of communication and access to information will be simply unavailable in some of the worst case scenarios, and thus I believe it is short-sighted to plan on only communicating using more primitive means such as radio. Of course, in the case of an EMP or a massive solar flare, there's a good chance that such networks will be non-functional for a very long period of time. However, in a variety of other scenarios, some amount of functionality will likely remain. It's important to remember that our local community, state, and nation do not live in a vacuum. I'll explain what I mean by that. Imagine that the continental United States experiences a trio of EMP blasts launched by a foreign actor. This would undoubtedly be extremely disruptive to daily life in North America and would likely be a significant disruption to societies and economies around the world. However, even if our own cellular land-based and server-based information and communication networks would be fried by such an attack, the same will not be true for the rest of the world. Even if some major online websites will be essentially disabled because many are housed by servers based in North America, many other parts of the internet will survive. Maintaining the ability to access those parts of the internet, most of which will be outside of our borders, could be a valuable asset to a prepper when trying to survive among millions of others that do not have such knowledge. The ability to access, for example, British newspapers in order to glean insight into the ongoing disaster could offer insight as to how the EMP attack was conducted, whether foreign invasion is a concern, how quickly services are being restored in the United States, and to dispel any rumors that may sprout up in an information vacuum. Additionally, the ability to communicate with individuals abroad in North America that have also retained access to the internet could allow for long-distance communication that would be far easier to manage than, for example, trying to communicate through ham radio. Using radio networks is neat and offers a great alternative, but there's a reason that the vast majority of the world's population communicates using cellular and satellite-based networks. When functional, they are far easier to use, and information can be more easily disseminated and consumed. How, you may ask, would a prepper have access to such networks if the entirety of the power grid in the United States is non-existent? The answer to that question is twofold. First, the most obvious solution would be to use a satellite-based means of communication. Satellite phones and satellite internet are both relatively common in today's world. Though many do not utilize satellite networks because of cost concerns or because, in the case of satellite internet for a house, can be less reliable in times. In normal circumstances, cellular and land-based internet can often be cheaper and more accessible. However, when cellular and land-based networks are likely to fail, it's reasonable to anticipate that satellite networks will likely remain usable in a variety of scenarios. Even if an EMP or solar flare were to wipe out a large number of satellites over a given geography, countless other satellites around the world would remain unaffected, and it's reasonable to believe that the ensuing void of communication satellites would be filled. Aside from satellite-based networks, it's not unreasonable to believe that cellular-based networks would remain functional under a variety of scenarios, even those that result in disruption to the power grid. Remember, there's a variety of scenarios that could result in brownouts or blackouts that don't revolve around EMPs or massive solar flares. Cyber attacks would be one such example. Such communication networks would be viewed as a high priority for governments to protect and keep functional. Even if reception is sparse or less than ideal, any ability to communicate through such means increases the capabilities of an individual or a community. In summary, the point of this entire subject of communication networks and the internet is to serve as a reminder for you, the prepper, and to counter the common perception that during worst-case scenarios, such networks would be entirely unusable by the average prepper. Though it is possible that they would be rendered useless, it is also reasonable to suggest that such networks will remain intact and will offer an important tool to anyone with the ability to utilize such networks. They are expensive, but satellite-based phones and the internet could be a well-spent investment for the average prepper. Powering those devices, however, is an entirely different matter that will be covered in the following segment. Tip number 13, any energy source is better than none. A common theme of this book thus far has been preparing for scenarios in which the power grid fails at either a local or a widespread level. Many everyday necessities and luxuries of modern life require the use of electricity. Furnaces, hot water heaters, air conditioning, stove and ovens, microwaves, lighting, garage door openers, cell phone networks, TVs, cell phones, computers, and a variety of other devices and systems are on a steady and uninterrupted supply of electricity. A widespread grid down scenario truly is one of the worst case scenarios for any community or nation. The average prepper must consider such scenarios. Even if a widespread and extended failure of the power grid may be viewed as unlikely, a localized and extended power outage is a fairly likely scenario that one should prepare for. In an ideal world, we would all be able to, afford solar panels or a wind turbine on our property and be able to disconnect our house's electricity systems from the grid, rendering us independent from the broader power grid and less affected by any grid failure. Of course, many of us cannot afford such a system or don't have the space for it. That, however, does not mean one should throw in the towel on any form of electricity generation. One of the main purposes of this discussion about power grid failure is to point out that preparing for the absolute worst case scenario, such as a complete failure of the national power grid that exceeds a full year in duration, may be unattainable by many preppers, but that any source of electricity is better than none. For example, a generator powered by gasoline, diesel, or natural gas is an option for short-term power production. The Achilles heel of generators is, of course, that they require a steady supply of fuel. Because it will not be able to provide power indefinitely, or at least for a period of several months, many will decide to forego such an option altogether, despite the value of a generator over the short term. A generator with a supply that lasts a few weeks is better than no generator and can provide power for your appliances, furnace, and other devices in a less than worst case scenario. I present to you a scenario that is likely to be relevant to anyone living in areas that suffer from long, cold winters. Modern day furnaces are reliant on electricity to both ignite the fuel source and to blow the heated air through the house. If the power grid were to fail for a few hours, those living in northern climes would find their house to be quite chilly, but if the power were to fail for several days, pipes would freeze and burst. Temperatures inside the house would fall below freezing. It would be a life-threatening situation for many individuals. Though it would be a disaster that only spans a few days, it is absolutely a scenario worth preparing for and is absolutely justification for buying a generator for such a purpose. If a power outage were to last for several weeks, the generator would still be of some value. The fuel could be rationed, thus extending the time frame in which you can keep your home heated. Of course, eventually the generator will run out of fuel, but as I said before, any sort of electricity is better than none, and those days or weeks of power can buy you and your family crucial time to devise alternatives. The same concept is true for other devices and appliances that would necessitate the use of a generator if the grid were to fail. During warmer months, a generator could aid in keeping a fridge and freezer cold, thus preserving its contents and allowing you more time to consume the food before it spoils. The capability to light your home, power your TV, or charge your phone can also be helpful for survival and comfort. Of course, smaller forms of power also exist. A small set of solar cells linked up to a charger can provide power that enables a wide variety of capabilities, all of which will improve your ability to survive. Though such power sources may be insufficient to power a furnace or a freezer, it allows you to, for example, charge your phone and more easily access the internet or communication networks. You would also have the ability to recharge batteries for flashlights or other battery-powered devices, and to use phones and laptops for leisure activities such as listening to an audiobook, reading on your device, or watching a movie or TV show that is saved on your device. Something as simple as scrolling through old photos and videos saved on the device can provide a brief respite from a disruptive period for you and your family. The benefits of the small solar-based charger or from the gas power generator can be achieved if we don't throw up our arms in frustration because we can't prepare for the worst-case scenario. Realize that this principle, a principle that states that something is better than nothing, extends throughout the spectrum of gear, supplies, and equipment that preppers often buy and store. Some food is better than none. A generator is better than nothing. A solar-based charger is better than nothing. 5 gallons of gasoline is better than none. A handgun chambered in .22 long rifle is better than nothing. The list goes on and on, but the principle is especially pertinent on the topic of electricity because I believe many preppers, when considering the wide spectrum of scenarios, leave themselves dreaming of a resilient, solar-powered, off-the-grid solution while also resigning themselves to living of a life devoid of electricity and electric devices until the power grid is repaired because of the cost of such a system. That's simply unnecessary. Any source of power is better than none and will significantly improve your chances of survival. Tip number 14, lose weight. Of all the tips provided in this book, this is the one tip that the largest number of people will have the most difficulty adhering to, myself included. Weight loss can be an incredibly difficult thing to achieve. Many individuals, preppers included, spend years trying to get rid of stubborn weight, and with good reason. The benefits of weight loss are numerous and far-reaching. Reducing your body weight, more specifically your body fat percentage, offers many health benefits and a quantifiable benefit to your survival chances in a variety of survival situations. I should add that though I am not obese, I could stand to lose some weight. I'm in the same boat as each prepper that this applies to. It's not my intention to belittle anyone, nor am I unfamiliar with just how difficult it can be to lose weight. I won't get caught up in all the specific health benefits of weight loss. Such information is readily available from a variety of sources, and those that require weight loss are likely already well aware of many of those benefits. From a health perspective, as it relates to prepping, I will add that weight loss can, for some, help reduce your dependency on certain medications. As previously discussed, dependency on any medication can leave you at a disadvantage in a survival situation, and no longer being dependent on such medications is always preferable. Of course, none of this is medical advice, and the discontinuation of medications on the basis of improved health and a lower body fat percentage should be something that is always done under the supervision of your doctor. Still, if it is something that you're able to achieve, it removes one additional barrier to your survival in any type of natural disaster or widespread collapse. Moving on, I want to discuss some of the quantifiable benefits of weight loss that are specific to preppers. Going back to the basics of survival, let's discuss calories and caloric expenditures. The example I will provide is for a 40-year-old, 5'10" male. When weighing 300 pounds, this individual will expend approximately 3,500 calories in a single day when engaging in moderate activity. If he can reduce his weight to 200 pounds, he will expend approximately 700 fewer calories in a day. That equates to 4,900 calories in a week, or approximately 21,000 calories in a month. That is 21,000 fewer calories that this individual needs to consume to maintain their body weight. That means the food stores will last longer. For the moms and dads reading this, that means more food for your children. How's that for motivation? Some will rationalize their higher body weight because the excess fat can serve as energy stores. While true, those excess fat reserves, when burned, are more likely to leave the individual in a state of near starvation. Not literal starvation, as the person will have many tens of thousands of calories still stored within their fat tissue, even after having lost a significant amount of weight. However, their body will react to the decreased caloric intake and revert to what we'll refer to as starvation mode. Consequences of this starvation mode include decreased energy, increased hunger at times, and a loss of muscle mass. Furthermore, psychologically, such rapid and extreme weight loss can be a very stressful process, and it's simply a poor idea to plan to lose large amounts of body weight during an otherwise stressful period in your life. The drawbacks to the excess body fat don't stop at an increased need for calories. The increased weight will make physical activity more difficult. Any potential bug-out plans that take place on foot will be far more difficult. You will have a decreased tolerance to high-effort activities such as farming or chopping wood. Running both short and long distances will be more difficult. Carrying packs on your back, wearing a tactical vest with body armor and magazines, or carrying a heavy weapon will be more fatiguing. Your usefulness in tactical situations, such as in self-defense and home defense, will be diminished. The physical and psychological stress placed upon any individual in such a situation makes focusing on fine motor tasks and making split-second decisions difficult. Those difficulties are further exacerbated when your cardiovascular system is overexerted or when your sympathetic nervous system is not accustomed to high-energy, physically strenuous tasks. It will leave you at a disadvantage and will put your life and the lives of those you love at an increased risk. The purpose of this discussion on weight loss is not to degrade anyone, nor is it to make any individual feel as though they are inferior because of their body weight or physical capabilities. Rather, it's simply to provide you with additional motivation to focus on weight loss through increased physical activity and a lower calorie diet. It's prepping in what is perhaps its purest form. Tip number 15, know your climate. As I work on this bit of the book, the temperatures outside are hovering just above 0 degrees Fahrenheit. That's balmy compared to what the temperatures have been over the past 48 hours, and with wind chills added, the negative 30 to negative 40 degree weather is downright cold. No, it's more than that. It's deadly. I will be honest in saying that for me, the deep cold of Minnesota winters is one of the most worrisome aspects of any sort of collapse scenario. The winters are long and cold, and I wonder how many would be able to survive in such an environment without the benefit of regular fuel supplies and electricity. Humans, of course, survived in such climates well before the advent of modern electricity and heating. Today's world, though, is ill prepared for a return to such primitive times. Knowing your climate and preparing accordingly is a tip that applies to nearly every reader of this book. It may apply more so to a resident of Phoenix, Arizona or Fargo, North Dakota, but in recent years we've been shown the impact that a winter storm can have on northern Texas or prolonged drought in Southern California. The focus of this topic is not the extraordinary disasters that can often strike around the world. Hurricanes, tornadoes, snowstorms, and monsoon preparation likely deserve a book of their own. Instead, I'm focusing on a few climatological features that can be detrimental to your survival. These are the regular but still deadly features of many climates. I want to focus on cold weather first because it's near and dear to my heart. Quite the opposite, actually. And it's plainly evident to me just how deadly a deep freeze can be. For those that live in areas prone to cold temperatures, it may seem as though it's common sense to prepare for cold weather events. Owning a heavy winter jacket, gloves, a hat, and boots is the extent of many individuals prepping. Most people have not considered living through a cold weather event without the aid of modern day luxuries, including electricity, natural gas distribution, and the use of their furnaces. When faced with situations in which these luxuries are unavailable, many will find themselves woefully unprepared. Cold weather events in many areas can last several weeks or even months. Minnesota winters are essentially a several month long cold weather event. I believe that there are three major layers of defense against these cold weather events. Each layer will offer extra protection and comfort that will, hopefully, last the duration of the cold weather. The first layer of defense is the use of a backup power generator. As previously mentioned, and as many homeowners are aware, furnaces used to heat the houses require electricity to function. An electrical current is required to run the motors that blow air throughout the house, and a spark is required to ignite the fuel source. For those that own furnaces that burn natural gas or fuel oil, the furnace is essentially useless without a power source. An alternative power source, such as a generator, is a prudent investment in your family's safety. Though they can cost a significant amount of money, they will prevent costly damages to your house as a result of frozen and burst pipes. For cold weather events that last for a period of days to weeks that also coincide with a failure of the power grid, a generator truly is an asset. If you want to take it a step further, other alternative power sources, such as solar power, are a viable option, though such systems are often out of the reach of some preppers' budgets. An interesting and novel approach to short-term electricity outages emerged during the cold weather that created a grid failure event in many parts of Texas in February of 2021. One man, using a 7.2-kilowatt generator that was a feature of his newly purchased Ford F-150, provided power to his freezer, a space heater, and a few other devices for several days. Such generators are an option, but it also raises the question of whether electric vehicles will be able to fulfill this role in the future. The battery packs, in most cases, would be sufficient to supply power for a few days, serving as a realistic stopgap measure at the obvious cost of decreased mobility. One final note on alternative sources of power. Generators vary widely in their features, capabilities, and operation. Become familiar with your generator ahead of time. Take the time to read the manuals and develop a basic understanding of how they operate, especially if you intend to use them with your house's electrical system rather than simply run an extension cord to power devices. The second line of defense against cold weather events is an alternative heat source. For some, this may be a wood stove or a fireplace. Though they both burn wood, the two differ significantly in terms of efficiency. You will find that the average wood stove will far outperform the average fireplace in terms of heating efficiency. More heat will stay inside the home rather than escape through the chimney. It's also less of a fire hazard, tends to allow less smoke in the house, and the chimneys tend to stay cleaner. In either case, I encourage you to test your fireplace or wood stove regularly, keeping an ample supply of fuel for the fires on hand, such as wood or compressed sawdust, and ensure your chimneys are in good working condition. Other alternative heat sources likely exist, but those two will be the most common, with the exception of a generator-powered space heater, and likely the safest. Unfortunately, many will likely resort to less safe heating methods, such as natural gas-fed stovetops and ovens, to heat their house. Such sources of heat are simply not safe for heating your home. Though they can work for cooking meals, they're not intended to be used for extended periods and can significantly increase carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide levels in your home, putting yourself and your family at risk. Candles or other small sources of heat, such as oil lamps, can do double duty as a source of light and a small source of heat. Some modifications, such as with ceramic pots, can be made to increase the amount of heat retained in the room, but such options will still be inadequate in dangerously cold temperatures. The third and most neglected defense against cold weather events is to consolidate the living spaces within your home and potentially between multiple households. This topic was previously discussed in a different context, but it absolutely applies to surviving cold temperatures. Allowing your friends, family members, or even your neighbors to stay in your home has several benefits. First, They can take advantage of any heat source that you may have on hand. This hypothetically could save their life. Second, if they have any fuel on hand to contribute to your generator or heater, such resources can be pooled together. Third, a large number of people in a small area automatically will increase the ambient temperature of the room. The increase in ambient temperature will not be adequate to replace a wood stove or a furnace, but with blankets, heavy clothing, and patience, you will find that it can still provide some relief from cold temperatures. This is especially true if multiple families consolidate not only to a single home, but a single room in that house. Be sure to ventilate. You know, the carbon dioxide exhaled by each individual can increase levels significantly. It won't be as comfortable, considering most in the United States are accustomed to sleeping in their own rooms. Privacy will be diminished. However, it is likely to increase the odds of survival. Survival, in the end, trumps comfort. On the other side of the spectrum, in terms of surviving your climate, is heat. Heat, like cold, can be deadly. A key difference between surviving extreme cold and extreme heat is that extreme cold almost always necessitates an outside source of heating. Extreme heat conditions generally do not require an external cooling source. This will make surviving such conditions somewhat more realistic in grid-down scenarios. During extreme heat, locating cooler areas should be the first step. Basements and cellars are often the most obvious choice. If you're outdoors, spending time in the shade goes a long way. Hydration is a crucial aspect of mitigating your risk of heat illness or death. Our body uses sweat to reduce its body temperature. When it cannot produce adequate amounts of sweat, we run into trouble. Ample amounts of clean drinking water and, in some cases, electrolytes can offset this risk significantly. Extra exertion and increased humidity will require even more hydration. Plan for this need for hydration by storing a large amount of purified water, as well as identifying and planning for an alternative water source and water purification methods that suit your situation. Another major risk during periods of extreme heat and humidity is heat stroke. Heat stroke can coincide with dehydration, but it's also important to understand that a well-hydrated individual can still suffer from heat stroke. It occurs when the core body temperature of an individual climbs to an excessive level. When that level is reached and sustained, certain systems within the body begin to shut down. Once again, hydration is an obvious way in which one can mitigate this risk. However, it's also important to consider one's level of physical exertion during hot and humid days, even when they are well hydrated. During especially hot periods, it's prudent to seek shade, utilize basements and cellars for their cooler temperatures, and avoid heavy labor. Save such labor for early morning or the evening, or, if necessary, nighttime. In cases of high temperatures, there will be certain individuals that will be especially sensitive to the heat and most prone to heat-related illness and death. These include elderly children, elderly individuals, young children, and those with disabilities that prevent them from voicing or fulfilling their needs, such as mentally or physically handicapped individuals. If you know someone that falls into those categories, check on them. Ensure they are receiving the appropriate supervision, hydration, and are coping well with the temperatures. The final major climatological feature I'd like to discuss is extreme droughts. Also included in this is areas in which rainfall is scarce under normal conditions, such as much of the southwestern United States. Modern technology has allowed us to inhabit areas that are essentially deserts in large numbers and with a greater population density than ever before. Much of that is enabled or made more comfortable by air conditioning, but a much more important development is the delivery of water from distant bodies of water and from deep underground. Like so many necessities of modern life, such supplies of water will quickly dry up in situations involving a widespread economic or societal collapse or a failure of the power grid. Large stores of fresh water are important for individuals that live in such geographies. Storage should be measured in the hundreds of gallons and, like with other preps, should take into consideration the needs of your family, loved ones, and neighbors. Remember, an individual can survive weeks or even months without food, but will die in a matter of days without water. The consequence of such a short window to provide aid in the form of water is that, in a grid-down situation, a majority of the population in water-scarce areas will be at a high risk of dehydration and death. A few bottles of water could extend one's life by a significant amount of time and will make a much more meaningful contribution than, for example, a can of beans. Plan to share your water with others in need, or else be prepared to see many die a quick death. In areas in which freshwater bodies of water are common or accessible, it's also important that you have a good plan for water purification. What water is available is likely to be polluted in one way or another, and it's important to prepare for that. Water purification methods, including filters, should be bought ahead of time. Tablets or larger systems are also an option. Additionally, it's important to consider alternative sources of water. In many areas, the water table may make a standard well unrealistic or something that is not legal because of zoning or other requirements and regulations. Collection of rainfall likely won't be a realistic way to supply yourself and your family with water, considering such areas are dry because of the lack of rainfall they receive in a given year. For many, bugging out may be the most viable long-term strategy. Perhaps water reserves can allow you to survive for weeks or even months, but eventually they will run dry. If a clean body of water can't fulfill that requirement, then it may simply be a matter of moving elsewhere. The grass, in this case, would truly be greener on the other side. As with the entirety of this book, the purpose of this discussion about managing under extreme weather and climatological conditions is not meant to be an in-depth discussion nor a comprehensive how-to manual. Instead, the purpose is to make you aware of your own deficits in prepping and to point you in the right direction of your potential solutions to those deficits. Tip number 16, don't count on bartering with silver and gold. I hope that much of what I've discussed thus far is not overly controversial, though I will, without a doubt, have some disagreement from some in the prepping community. However, I doubt I will find more disagreement or create more controversy than with this next discussion about precious metals. That's partly true because of my background in the precious metals sector. If you're not aware, I'm the host and creator of the Silver Fortune podcast on YouTube and most major podcast platforms, where I discuss, among other things, silver and gold. I'm a big fan of silver and gold. I think they offer vital protection to an individual from currency debasement, economic collapse, and serve as both a speculative investment and means of preserving your wealth. However, I have often said in previous podcasts that when it comes to collapse and survival scenarios, the worse the disaster is, the less useful physical silver and gold will be. Simply put, you cannot eat your silver and gold, nor can you drink them or put them in your gas tank for fuel, nor can you heat your house with silver and gold. But Matt, what if I trade silver and gold for those items? Excellent question. I think that in any widespread collapse, whether it is because of widespread warfare, economic reasons, or societal reasons, there will be a time and place for bartering with silver and gold. However, that time will not be within the first days, weeks, or even months following the beginning of the more severe collapses. There may be some potential for bartering with silver and gold for necessities such as food, water, gas, medicine, etc., but you are not likely to get the fair value for the metals. The reason for this is that in a survival situation, the individuals you are bartering with would be most concerned with their survival. Bartering through the use of food, water, fuel, etc., directly impacts their ability to survive. Silver and gold do not. They may serve as a means of bartering for some other necessity, but in and of themselves, they do not directly contribute to their survival. And because of that, I believe that many individuals will imply a significant discount to any value of precious metals in the most severe of scenarios. Long, drawn-out economic collapse or hyperinflation may yield a very different result, such has been the case or such has been seen in Venezuela during their recent and ongoing periods of hyperinflation. Reports of individuals using flakes of gold for purchasing daily goods have surfaced, and indeed, I believe silver and gold could be a very viable means of barter in such scenarios. However, in the so-called Mad Max scenarios, I do not think that will be the case. For precious metals owners or those that are interested in precious metals, I'm not saying that one should not buy them as a prep. They're absolutely a form of economic prepping, have viable uses in certain economic and hyperinflation scenarios, and are assets that I believe to be significantly undervalued. They are very likely to be highly valued, if not overvalued, as societies, economies, and the world regain their footing following any widespread collapse or reset. That makes a It makes for a great case to buy and hold precious metals in the meantime. However, I still believe that trading necessities such as food, water, fuel, water, or gear will be more advantageous and realistic. In summary, precious metals can be an important part of your investment portfolio. Of course, take none of this as an investment advice, just my own opinion and thoughts, and certainly are a prudent use of your capital in preparing for a variety of adverse outcomes in our modern day economic and monetary system. However, in the worst case scenarios, I believe bartering with precious metals would not work nearly as well as some would expect. Tip number 17, government can be good. If the discussion about precious metals was unpopular for those that own precious metals, my views on the government in a collapse or disaster scenario will be even more controversial among those in the prepping community. Let me preface it with this. I'm not a fan of many facets of the government in the modern day United States of America. In general, I find that the less local a government is, the less effective it is, and the less likely it is that I will be a fan of it. For example, I'm not opposed to many local government services, nor am I opposed to some other aspects of my local government. Conversely, I believe that much of what the federal government does is, well, problematic. For the sake of not over-politicizing this discussion, I'll leave it at that. However, having spent quite some time in the prepper community, I believe that the same can be said for the vast majority of preppers. Distrust of the government, especially the federal government, among preppers is very common. I hold a similar level of distrust. With all that being said, I think it is important that each prepper use discernment in their interpretation of government actions in any disaster or collapse scenarios. Let me explain. There will be instances in which a local, state, federal, or even foreign government may provide assistance or intervene in a manner that is in the individual prepper's best interest or the best interest of their community. Some examples of these actions include distribution of food and water, restoration of basic local services, providing a central authority to fight and deter crime, repairing damaged utilities and infrastructure, and providing other assistance to citizens in need. At face value, any of the previously listed actions are objectively good for both you and your community. To anyone that disagrees, I'd encourage you to explain how any of those actions are detrimental to yourself or your community. But hold on a second, though, before any of you grab your pitchforks. I'm not naive. Governments often have ulterior motives hidden behind otherwise seemingly benevolent actions. For example, it's not such a stretch to expect a stated goal of crime deterrence to turn into a crackdown on a certain group of people that may otherwise be law-abiding citizens. You, a gun-toting prepper, may be seen as a potential criminal. Your political views or law-abiding gun ownership could attract the ire of those providing security. In this sense, full-blown martial law technically could be referred to as crime deterrence. Other acts of assistance, such as distribution of food and water, while on the surface benevolent, could have strings attached. It could also promote reliance on government services. The conundrum for preppers with such distrust is that in the vast majority of observable disasters, small-scale collapses or localized crap-hits-the-fan situations over the past several decades, those ulterior motives for government action were rarely witnessed by any of us, nor were they reported by those that lived through such circumstances. So which is it, Matt? Do you trust the government or not? By default, I think both caution and discernment are required. That means that we should not default to distrust nor blind trust of the government in any of these situations. Depending on the situation, accepting help from the government, or at the very least, not disrupting their efforts to assist your community can be the right decision. They may simply be looking to deliver necessities and prevent the loss of life. In other situations, they may truly be looking to deter crime, crime that will likely be rampant in many collapse or natural disaster scenarios. The purpose of this is not to implore each of you to trust the government, whether it be the state, local, or federal, in every situation. Instead, the purpose is to push back against the echo chamber of voices that express their constant distrust of the government and project that distrust onto any conceivable collapse or disaster scenario. Taking such an approach can leave you isolated from your community, can leave your family confused and frustrated why you would be unhappy with a government handing out aid or providing security, and may feed into a dangerous groupthink that preppers, just like any other group of people, are absolutely prone to. Such groupthink can lead to conflict between these groups of like-minded individuals and the government. Those conflicts can then feed into narratives of the media, government, and those prepper communities. For those that express distrust of the government, it can serve as a confirmation of the very concerns they expressed originally, despite the fact that they may have been the aggressors against any government. For the government, it can be seen as unrest or violence that, in their mind, is unjustified. Escalation is bound to ensue. I might seem like a broken record at this point, but I once again remind you that the purpose of each of these individual topics is not to tell you exactly what to do, but to provide you food for thought, expose potential weaknesses in your preparations, and to ask questions that will prompt oneself to ask themselves more questions and adjust their plans and mindset accordingly. In the case of responding to the government in a collapse or disaster scenario, I believe many preppers need to rethink their mindset and consider the consequences of making incorrect assumptions. Tip number 18, be prepared to serve. The topic of community engagement, getting to know your neighbor, and approaching prepping from a community-based perspective rather than as a lone wolf, is a concept that is common enough in today's prepper communities that I felt it would be unnecessary to place on this list. However, I do want to discuss the struggle that many will face while trying to get their community, most of whom will not be preppers, on board with plans and preparations that you likely will have spent many hours considering and many thousands of dollars preparing for. You, the prepper, may not have the expertise of an army officer, a doctor, an EMT, a farmer, or any variety of other skills and professions. What you do have, however, is your prepper mindset. In addition, you also have the considerable physical preps you have accumulated over months and years. Those in your community are likely to look to you, the prepper, for direction in a situation that mirrors the very circumstances you've prepared for. Sure, they may not defer to you on matters of medical expertise, instead referring to the medical expert. In matters of farming, they will defer to the farmer. In matters of prepping, they will defer to you. Your community will look to you for answers and direction. The problem that I envision many preppers facing is that, though we may all be preppers, not all of us may be natural-born leaders. Furthermore, leading a diverse group of people that likely did not see eye to eye on some of the most basic of matters before any collapse is a significant challenge. Individuals in your community will challenge your leadership. Others will challenge you for leadership of the community in an attempt to usurp any appointed authority. My advice is twofold. First, if you expect to have a positive impact on your community because of your expertise, be prepared to serve. People are far more likely to respect and listen to you if you are prepared to serve in a meaningful way. Simply making decisions, plans, and telling people what to do will not be considered serving. Participating in backbreaking labor, volunteering for the least desirable of jobs, such as the aforementioned duty of collecting the human waste in the community, thus improving the smell and water quality for all, and placing yourself in other positions of service is likely to win over the hearts and minds of the very people that you are seeking to help. The second piece of advice is a tip I already mentioned. Not everyone is cut out for leadership. That's okay. In fact, you'll probably have a much more enjoyable time if you avoid such a role. The leaders are often the ones cleaning up messes, putting out fires, and catching the most flack out of anyone in the community. With that being said, you can still put your expertise to use. If you recognize that you are not cut out for leadership, defer that position to someone who is. Use your expertise and willingness to serve selflessly in order to win them over and influence them into making decisions that are prudent and in the best interest of the community. By doing so, you avoid the downsides of leadership, spare your community the faulty leadership of somebody who may not be cut out for such a role, and still impart your knowledge, wisdom, and prepared mindset to the leader for the good of the community. Tip number 19, house fires are a legitimate threat. In a reality in which modern forms of heating a home, cooking food, and providing light are unavailable, countless households will turn to alternatives. Many of these have been discussed thus far, but they include the use of wood stoves, fireplaces, candles, campfires, small alcohol-based stoves, and grills. In addition, we can add the misuse of natural gas or propane-fired stoves and ovens for the use of heating rather than cooking, as well as their use in general with inadequate ventilation. Each of these methods will be born out of either necessity or in an attempt to simplify one's life. However, few in the first world will be accustomed to using such sources of heat and light. Nearly all of these heat and light sources will significantly increase the risk of house fires. That was the case over 100 years ago when such sources were the norm, and it certainly will be again when households turn to such methods. Don't add yourself and your family to that statistic. There is a time and place for each of these sources of heat and light, but misuse and carelessness will be what results in a large increase in deadly and destructive fires. It's important to understand that some sources of heat are simply not meant to be used indoors, such as small alcohol-based survival stoves. The same is true for charcoal grills. Misuse of gas-fired stoves and ovens will also increase the risk of house fires, along with the risk of carbon monoxide poisoning, but we'll discuss that later. Unattended fireplaces can quickly throw off sparks and embers that can ignite nearby fuel sources. Ideally, candles should be placed in a cup or dish and placed at some distance from easily ignitable fuel sources, such as clothing, linens, and paper. Even outdoor campfires, if created during dry and windy conditions, and when built too close to a residence or near dry fuel sources, can easily create fires that can burn down entire houses, fields, and forests. Another fire risk stems from electrical devices. Using space heaters or other electrical devices using a generator and extension cords can overload such cords of poor quality or insufficient capabilities. Don't go the cheap route with such cords. Follow guidelines for the capability of such cords and follow other guidelines such as limitations on the number of cords that can be linked together. Invest in a suitable fire extinguisher. They aren't difficult to use and can slow or even smother a fire before it gets out of control. Additionally, it is a purchase that serves a role even when the world isn't falling apart around you. Finally, make sure you have working smoke detectors. Smoke detectors are generally designed to work off the grid and can make a world of a difference in situations in which seconds matter. A house fire is likely one of the most preventable causes of death in a collapse or natural disaster. And you must take the time to plan for how you will heat your home, cook your food, and use open flames for extra light. These are simple mistakes that already kill scores of people each year. In any scenario in which the power grid has failed and emergency services, including the fire department, are not available, such deaths are likely to become far more common. Don't become part of that statistic. Tip number 20, pay attention to air quality. Adjacent to this discussion on proper sources of heat and light is the topic of air quality. Each of the previously listed forms of cooking, heating, and light that involve combustion of a fuel can contribute to poor air quality. Specifically, the burning of any fuel will increase carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide levels in an unventilated space. Carbon monoxide, of course, is generally the more dangerous of the two. This is because of how it inhibits oxygen transportation in our bloodstream. Carbon monoxide poisoning can be subtle at first, mimics the symptoms of other diseases and illnesses, and can be extremely deadly once the onset has begun. The key to preserving proper indoor air quality is to first avoid the misuse of any source of heat. For example, wood stoves and fireplaces that lack adequate ventilation or have chimneys that are partially or completely blocked will lead to increased levels of carbon monoxide. Indoor stoves and ovens that utilize gas as a fuel also create carbon monoxide as a byproduct. This is part of why such appliances should not be used to heat the home. The consistent production of carbon monoxide will put the house's occupants at risk. Carbon monoxide production by an open flame increases as oxygen is depleted in the air. This means that ventilation is important not only to get rid of built-up carbon monoxide, but also to ensure enough oxygen is present to adequately combust the fuel. Even candles, when lit in a small enclosed space, such as a car or a tent, can cause this problem if lit in a number too numerous for the small space. The ventilation in such systems is what makes those heat sources safe to use when such appliances are working properly. Ventilation is also key for other indoor flames. It's common sense that a wood stove or a fireplace requires a chimney to vent the smoke and other byproducts of the flame. No one, hopefully, in their right mind, would do otherwise. Such fires have the advantage of visible, smelly smoke that, in large concentrations, make breathing difficult. That's not the case for many candles. They do produce some smoke, but not as much. Natural gas appliances, kerosene lamps, oil lamps, or alcohol survival stoves, they give the appearance of being a cleaner source of heat. In a sense, that is the case. Such sources of heat tend to more completely combust the fuel when compared to wood stoves or fireplaces. However, the carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide that they emit is just as real as that emitted by a fireplace, and the same risks exist. In cases in which open flames are used because of cold temperatures, don't be tempted to skip ventilation because you'll be letting in cold air. I'm not saying you have to leave a window wide open because it renders such sources of heat entirely ineffective, but don't expect those gases to escape in the crack under a door or similarly small spaces. Whenever you're using a flame to heat your house that is not contained within a furnace, ventilation is absolutely necessary to prevent illness or death. Another source of carbon monoxide that I haven't yet mentioned is generators. Generators should never be kept indoors, with the sole exception of the very large generators that are designed to be kept inside large buildings, such as in a hospital, and have a purpose-built ventilation system. The average generator owned by a prepper is not meant to be kept indoors. Doing so would be akin to parking your car in your living room and turning on the engine. Furthermore, it's important to keep your generator at a safe distance from any entry point into the house. Doors, windows, or air intake pipes are some examples. Failure to do so will allow the exhaust from the generator engine to enter into your house and degrade the air quality. Some generators burn quite clean and are not overly smelly, so remember that scent alone is not a good guide. Carbon monoxide, after all, is entirely odorless. Keep generators away from any areas in which air will enter the house, and you'll prevent any of the all-too-common incidences of carbon monoxide poisoning caused by the devices. Tip number 21, don't neglect leisure. Generally speaking, prepping is a serious process that is undertaken to prevent some very serious outcomes for yourself and your family. Most preppers place their focus on the necessities of life, and rightfully so. Food, water, heat, security, shelter, health, the physical preps that we purchase, the skills we learn, and the knowledge we accumulate. However, I believe that it is wise to not neglect leisure. I'm defining the term broadly because leisure activities vary for each individual based on their preferences. Such activities are important to human survival and morale. It can offer an escape, a distraction from any ongoing collapse and its sobering consequences. It's important that you, the prepper, plan to accommodate these needs. Forms of leisure that don't require electricity are far easier to plan for. For example, books, board games, sports equipment, and the like are things that many of us already possess. Of course, in today's world, many individuals, especially adolescents, are not accustomed to using board games or books as their primary source of entertainment. Instead, they often turn to digital forms of entertainment. Music, videos, movies, and the like are what make up the primary source of entertainment for many in Generation Z, Millennials, and even some of Generation X. Though it may be difficult to utilize digital forms of leisure during a variety of collapse or disaster scenarios, I encourage you not to rule out the idea. Many modern electrical devices, because of their large amounts of storage, can store entire movies or seasons of a TV show, negating the need for any Wi-Fi or cellular network. The same is true for digital music. Nearly every smartphone can run a wide variety of games, appropriate for nearly any age. Powering each of these devices can be somewhat of a challenge. Not everyone will have a generator or have fuel for a generator, and most do not have solar power or wind power for their homes. However, something as simple as a small set of solar cells linked with a charger can be adequate for charging such devices. Charging using such a device can be time consuming, but it's difficult to put a price on the escape digital forms of escape can provide in a long-term survival situation. Any of these forms of leisure, especially the digital ones, will provide a distraction from reality and a form of relaxation that will give oneself an escape from a frightful world. Some will call it a coping mechanism, and they may not be incorrect. Others will say that it's best to move on from any old reality and become acquainted with the current. You yourself may believe yourself to be mentally tough enough to not require such distractions. That may be the case. Conversely, you may also find yourself more capable to remain focused in a world turned upside down when you partake in temporary forms of escape. Furthermore, others in your family, such as your children, may not have the mental toughness required for such scenarios. Limited amounts of screen time or other forms of digital entertainment will help them better cope with the drastic changes in their life. Leisure, especially digital leisure, is a topic that is all too often neglected in the prepper community. But I believe that giving it proper attention and planning will improve morale within your household and will help each individual better cope with what likely will be one of the most tumultuous periods in their life. Conclusion. I truly hope that the preceding 21 tips have helped cover gaps in your preparation. I, myself, am aware of gaps in my own preps, but even worse than those gaps that I'm aware of are the gaps that I am unaware of. It has been my desire to help cover some of those gaps, add food for thought for unique situations, and help you avoid any unforced errors in any future survival situation. If you enjoyed this book, I encourage you to subscribe to Silver Fortune on YouTube. I'm also on most major podcast platforms. Additionally, I encourage you to check out my Civil Strife series on Amazon. There's a link down below in the description of this video audiobook, or on this podcast platform. Zero Sum, a post-apocalyptic economic and societal collapse thriller, Civil Strife series, book one. Here's what it's about. Here's the description. An act of terrorism brings the financial system to a grinding halt. Premeditated violence and waves of unrest sweep across the continent. In a time of polarization and distrust, a more sinister force is behind this attempt to bring about a new America. However, this political subterfuge is met with violent opposition. In the confusion, the coast-to-coast chaos takes on a life of its own, bringing about a sudden collapse of American civilization. The two warring factions leave millions caught within a zero-sum game, with each individual finding themselves fighting for survival in a complete societal and economic collapse. This page-turner, the first entry into the Civil Strife series, will keep you at the edge of your seat with each twist. An unexpected attack on the fabric of U.S. society quickly unravels into an all-out fight for survival. Those that are caught in the middle are left reeling as they try to adjust to a new normal and navigate a fractured society that is more divided than ever. And here's a bonus. The second book of this series will be coming out February of 2022, probably later in the month. So that's another thing to be looking forward to if you're the type of person that likes series and you don't like waiting for the next book to come out. Well, book two is going to be out in no time, or for those of you that are, catching this at some point in the future, it's already out and I'm already working on book three, four, wherever we're at here in the future. So, for each of you that have tuned into this pretty lengthy audio book, I appreciate that. I appreciate your support. I appreciate your interest in this topic. Be sure to subscribe to this channel or to this podcast, depending on where you're listening. Thank you from the bottom of my heart, and God bless.